club administrators, and maybe even players themselves. Welcome to another episode of Shot Happens, your podcast about travel soccer and how to survive it from a practical standpoint. This is again Robert Hay, and again I'm with my co-host, partner in crime, Reed Maltby. Reed, we're going to talk about something a little bit high level tonight. We're going to talk about U.S. soccer. A couple episodes back, I asked you about U.S. soccer, what you would change in concussion rules if you were the president of U.S. soccer. So now you get a chance to talk a little bit more about the organization itself.
Oh, great.
Nothing controversial about that, right?
No, big, huge target on my back. Awesome. Yeah, but that sounds good to me.
Good. So you're going to be the bad cop and I'll be the good cop. Wonderful. I'll be eminently hireable by U.S. soccer. Well, let's just dive right into this. The reason for this topic is we want to talk about, you know, what happens at U.S. soccer inevitably trickles down to our clubs, our teams, and how they play. And I want to start the discussion with an example from my club recently. Before my club started playing this year, about a week and a half, maybe a week before the season began. So again, we're talking probably 4 weeks of practice. We're leading up to the game, a week out from the first game in the league. The league sends out a note to parents saying, oh, by the way, we've got this new rule we're introducing to play, and it's the build-out rule that U.S. soccer has asked our age group to implement in order to, you know, make our players into better ball handlers and better skill and so on and so forth. Now, the build-out rule we can get into, but the long and short of it is essentially it's a way to back off the defense in order to let the team with possession, you know, the keeper with possession, start the play and allow a little bit more space for the play to start for the offensive team. But my concern was, you know, this was announced fairly close to the beginning of the season, and the coaches had to go and spend valuable practice time rushing to explain to players and to parents to an extent exactly what this rule is. The fields had to be set up slightly differently. You know, the referees had to be brought in on the conversation so they know how to enforce this rule. And it was all because U.S. soccer thinks that this rule is the best way to improve our players and make them better soccer players. So with that long intro, Coach, let me ask you a question first. When you were a club administrator, how did you feel your relationship with U.S. soccer was?
How did I feel my relationship with U.S. soccer was as a club administrator? I was a minion carrying out their orders. No, I'm just kidding. Now, here's the thing. So when I was actually a club administrator, which was a couple years ago, I was already dealing with the this issue. So the build-out rule was actually announced like 2 years ago. It was part of that whole packet of development that came out from U.S. soccer. So we were aware of it a couple years back. So the onus was on the leagues to trickle. It was on the people who were in know to trickle that down to like the leagues and the teams, et cetera. And that's, I think, where the breakdown might have occurred with you all is we were aware of it. We were given 2 years to start to move towards these mandates. Mm-hmm. And then after 2 years in 2017, they were going to become official. So in defense of U.S. soccer, it wasn't just dropped on us last second. But having said that, there was always a lot of confusion from all of us around when to implement, how to implement, what it'll look like, why it's being done. So even when they were given to us back in 2015, we still struggled with, oh my gosh, you know, what are we doing here? In theory, the build-out rule makes total sense. But my comment always was two things. One, you can't legislate good coaching. It's just like growing up going to a Catholic school. My Catholic professors used to always, we'd get into conversations about like euthanasia and things like that. We took these, you know, social issues classes, and you know, my teacher said you can't legislate morality. You just can't make rules to tell people how to act morally. You can't. It's got to be something inherent. And it's the same thing. We can't legislate good coaching. If you're creating rules because you don't like the way the players are being developed, then maybe we need to look at the coach training system, right? And train mm-hmm. the coaches better. And that's always been one of my arguments is, here's the thing. We got this outcomes-based mentality where we got teams punting the ball and jamming it upfield so they can score as many goals as possible and all this other stuff happening. And we're not doing anything about fixing that. And we've got all these misguided coaches out there who have no software skills whatsoever. They know X's and O's really well, but they don't know how to interact with children. And it's because we don't do anything to train them on that. So build out rule in theory is a great idea, but it works in other countries. It's been done in other countries because those coaches may have been better prepared to implement, if that makes sense. So that was one piece of the puzzle. And I guess we can continue to argue through that, and then I'll bring up my second issue with all of it. So
yeah, let's talk about the coaching for a minute, because you bring up a good point. There was an article in the, I believe it was the New York Times, and if I'm wrong, maybe struck down by the podcast gods, about the Italian soccer academy, coaching academy, and the idea where, you know, to get your coaching license, you go through this intense training and testing and everything like that. And the big takeaway from the article is there is no style. If you come in with a style, your style, you fail. I mean, it's an automatic fail if you'd mention the words your style or something to that effect. So it's interesting, you know, that they have this the mentality of, you know, flexibility to be able to adjust to situations and things like that. Whereas in, you know, the example that we were just talking about, you have the U.S. Soccer Federation mandating a style, and it's not a style of play, but it's this method to almost create this style of play. You know, it's this is the best way, coaches, you know, go ahead and do it this way and try and do coaching education, it seems like, in this manner rather than actually training coaches.
So, one, that was my live today, was exactly that. I was talking about adapting to coaches need to be like water, right? You don't – water takes the shape of its environment. It doesn't force the environment to shape to it. And water finds the path of least resistance, and it keeps going until it finds a way. And yet what we do as coaches is kids come to us and we're like, you're going to play this style because that's my style. And if a kid doesn't fit it, we push them aside, or we just keep hammering them until they fit, right? No, you adapt to the kids in front of you, right? And so I'm laughing because Didier Deschamps did that article on adaptation, and I'm also laughing because – I had a conversation once with a person who came from the MLS and then was a Development Academy scout for U.S. soccer. And I had this extremely successful team. And it's because I went out and I didn't pick on talent. I picked on culture. And I chose my team based on culture, and I chose my team based on what I needed. I picked the personnel. I didn't just say, I'm going to pick the 11 biggest, fastest, strongest, best soccer players on the field at tryouts. I went out and I was like, I need this. So I had carnivores and I had herbivores on the same team. You know, as they say, you know, I had vegetarians and, you know, I had kids that were playmakers and I had the kids that were killers. They just went out and scored goals, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at these kids and we started developing formations around their abilities and what they brought to the table. And these boys were remarkable. And so I had them run in two or three different formations, and they would play a different formation based on who they were playing or how they were playing that day or who was there and who wasn't. And I moved them all around, and it was like they could change formations mid-game. They were so good at this. And this scout comes up and says, I'm worried about your team. I said, why? He says, well, they're not adapting to the system. And I was like, what system? He goes, well, our club now has a system of play, and you need to play a style of play. And I was like, no, you play with the tools that you're given. I mean, if you hand me a chisel and a hammer and tell me to paint the Mona Lisa, I'm not going to be able to do it. You're going to think I'm the worst flipping coach on the planet. But if you hand me a paintbrush and a canvas, I may be able to, and some color paint, I may be able to pull it off. You know, it's like you can't make me make my kids who play a certain way based on the talents they have and they brought to the table play your style. You can't do that. Well, we can. That's how we do it at this club. And we're not going to get a DA designation if you don't do it the way I tell you. And I'm like, okay. And then I said, well, what style of play are you prescribing here? Because I've been at this club for like 7 years now, man. And he goes, well, it's more like the Barcelona style. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, my kids play a Dutch style. And he goes, yeah, that's the wrong style. I was like, okay. They play a Dutch style. And I said it again. He's like, that's the wrong style. We play the Barcelona style. I said, do you know who started the style at Barcelona? So here's the thing. I'm so frustrated because I am sure he was just a robot carrying out orders. But, man, people around the world and people in our country talk about how we're one of the biggest countries and we have so much athletic talent. Look how we do at the Olympics and all the other sports. We dominate the world, and yet we can't in soccer. And it's like, you know, why aren't we using – and it's the whole athlete comment. It's not that. It's not that we're not using athletes in soccer like we do in other sports. It's that we're forcing them to play one way instead of taking the personnel we have – and figuring out what's the best style for them, and taking a country of 3 million soccer players and letting them groom and develop under their own styles and then figuring the system out. And that's what they're doing. And that's what Italy means by you should have no style when you come into the academy or you'll get failed, because you shouldn't. You should be watered and adapt to the environment into which you're put. And so should our players, right? So the disservice that we do to those players is I force them for 7 years to play a certain style at my club because that's what I'm told to force them to. And then they go and they play for a different coach, and that style is – or worse, we've seen it. Our players go overseas and they don't quite fit in. Why? Because they were taught to play a certain way and a certain way only. And then they go to Italy and Italy's like, we don't play that way. They can't adapt because we never taught them to adapt.
And then they stop going to Italy altogether. They stop going to some of these countries altogether, and it becomes very inward focused. And we tend not to travel too far away from home, kind of situation. But that's a larger issue. So we're obviously let's talk about the 2015 rule changes and guidance that was handed down. I mean, there was a couple of things. Why don't you run through some of the big things? Because I know there's one big issue that continues to reverberate through U.S. soccer.
The age mandate.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. The build outline. The numbers.
Hmm.
7v7 versus 6v6 and the field sizes.
Yep.
Here's my issue with the field sizes. The field sizes, if you do the square footage, actually do not get bigger, and yet we've added more players. And the excuse is, well, we want soccer to be more like futsal. They're two completely different sports for
mm-hmm.
one. And two, the players who are very good at futsal play it inherently on their own at play when they're not at soccer, and we can't force that upon them. What we do with children who are already in high anxiety situations when we add constraints that they aren't ready for is we create panic attacks. So we get really good at goal kicks and throw-ins because that's where the ball is always going to end up
mm-hmm.
because there's a lot more people crammed into a lot smaller space, and yet they don't have the confidence or skill set yet, foundational skills, to navigate that space. It's like taking kids and, you know, cramming a year's worth of math into a week and expecting them to perform at high performance. That's my opinion. But what do I know?
But you can set up different. You can set up two math classes one next to each other because you have smaller field spaces.
Yeah, exactly. So that's and that's what
more
happens.
Soccer.
What they did is basically what I heard through grapevines, and I kind of trust who told me, is that they sat down with a map of most full size fields and said, how do we cram all these fields into these full size parks so that we don't have to build new parks and force clubs and everybody to adapt to new fields and everything. And so they basically tried to cram these 77 and 99 fields into 11v11 fields, which means that it ended up being a little bit less square footage space with more players on the field. The build outline, though, is actually a good idea, because what you're going to have is you're going to have those coaches are going to game the system and take full advantage of the, look, we're not going to punt anymore. Kids can't do head balls at certain ages, so everything's going to be played out of the back, and you're going to have those coaches that are just going to get the carnivores that just steal the ball off the defender's foot every time it's played to them. The build out line in theory was, hey, this gives them a chance to get a touch and get organized before they go forward. Of course, I had one very intelligent coach in one of the meetings we had where we were on conference call talking about this stuff and arguing over 2015, who said, great, now what's going to happen is some guy's going to go out and get all the biggest, meanest, strongest kids and line them up along the build out line, and when that first touch happens, they're going to plow them like kill a man with a ball.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. It's like, again, you can't legislate good coaching. If you just teach the coaches not to teach that style of play, or at least, vet our coaches, then we wouldn't have to be worrying about the ones that game the system.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a workaround for most everything, and that's kind of tends to be what happens when you put on rules like this, is that some smart person finds a way around it to get the goals that they want. But well, let's touch the hotline. Let's talk about the age changes. I'm going to throw a theory out there to you, and I want to hear your response based on your experience. Because I think this is my experience with, being a coach of a child who jumped an age group because of the age changes. I think we're losing a generation of young soccer players, or we will lose a generation of young soccer players or two, because while there was a transition period, as you mentioned, for these rules, a lot of clubs seem to have put in the age change and the calendar year changes almost immediately rather than over time period. And because of that, we're taking existing teams and existing players and bumping them up quicker than maybe they should have been in some cases.
So, and I agree. My kids both quit soccer after the age change. One said it was because he was on the third team at our club and he was in the right spot. I actually they put him on the second team, and I argued with them, but I was like, all right. And then once the season started, I said, can we now put him on the third team? Because I knew it's scaffolding. It's zone of proximal development. It's Vygotsky. We just talked about this. My son was over-challenged on the second team. He's a good little player, but he was over-challenged. He went to a team where he was in a better environment where iron sharpened iron, and he got to be a really good little player on that third team. Well, guess what? He was the oldest kid on his third team. So guess what happens when the age change, when the age change would happen? My son would end up, he's a December birthday, my son was going to end up with all the kids from the A team. And he said, I'm not ready for that. I'd rather not go through that stress. He was in the perfect environment for development before we did the age change. My other son said, I won't be with my friends anymore. I don't want to play. So, and again, 99% of these kids are not going to play for the national team. 99% of these kids are not going to play in the pros. 97% aren't even going to play in college probably. And yet, that decision was made, and they're walking away from the sport. And sports isn't there to create a World Cup championship or to win Olympic medals or to go pro. Sports was there to put them in front of role models, learn life skills, gain values, and succeed in life beyond the game. And when we drive children out in droves from the game itself, we miss out on the opportunity to give them those gifts. And when they're quitting the sport by 14, we've missed those vital years when we can be teaching them what matters more, and that's to be successful human beings after the game. So, but the age change was made because we wanted to keep up with the world. Because on high, the decision is we want to win a World Cup at all costs. Win at all costs. Now, here's the thing. We've won 3 World Cups. You just won't recognize them.
Okay. I do from having a daughter playing soccer. I know I do.
Here's my problem. What I want to know is if the U.S. somehow makes it to Russia and wins that World Cup, are we going to put a star on all the U.S. jerseys and make the women wear a star as well? Because if we are, we should have 4 stars on those darn jerseys.
Mm-hmm.
See, that happened. That's happened in other countries where the women have won championships, and the argument has been, why aren't the men forced to wear the star when you're forcing the women to wear the star? Yeah, right?
Mm-hmm.
I really struggle with this because it was said. It's been said publicly. All I care about is winning a World Cup. Well, then you're making the decision for 22 men, and you're doing it on the backs of 3 million children who will never see that jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And you're forgetting the fact that we've done it 3 times with the women.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe ask the women what they do.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe look at that side of development. Well, I remember when this, you know, rule change was announced, and I saw, you know, read the interviews with club officials and, you know, both locally and nationally, and it was almost a sheepishness when they talked about it. It was like, well, you know, we need to do what's best for our players, and we're going to implement this, but we're going to help them work through it, and we're going to offer, you know, clinics, we're going to offer meetings, but there was almost a sheepishness about in the interviews with these club officials where they're like, yeah, we're going to do this. We have to do this. We're going to make the best out of a bad situation. I mean, you know, why? I mean, I'm going to ask the dumb question. Why do it? I mean, why listen to U.S. soccer? What's the downside to sitting there and saying, yeah, you know, maybe we'll do this over a little bit longer period of time?
To steal a quote from Richard Bailey, Dr. Richard Bailey, unfortunately, I don't have as much credibility and power as Dr. Richard Bailey, so I'm probably completely shooting myself in the foot. But I don't care anymore. My wife and I were talking about it the other day. She goes, you know what, Reed, you just got to start calling spades, babe. You got to call people out. She's like, you're the one with 2 master's degrees. Some of those guys don't have master's degrees at all. They don't understand the science. So she's like, just call them out. I'm going to call them out. Richard Bailey says that a lot of times the governing bodies in certain sports are basically like the mafia. You do as I say. You know, hey, look. This is how it is, and if you don't like it, you got nowhere to go. So pay your money, do what we tell you. I mean, that's what he jokes about, and it is. Where are you going to go? Everybody made it very clear. If you choose not to do what's being handed down from U.S. soccer, where are you going to play? What league are you going to be in? What club are you – how are you going to get sanctioned? How are you going to host tournaments? How are you going to raise – you can't. You're stuck.
Yeah.
And guess what? Your coaches are trained by them, so you're stuck there too. You got to do what they say.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you know, as Richard says, a lot of times it's that, and then there's no responsibility for the outcome. And the thing is look, again, 3 million kids are registered to play soccer in the U.S. under, you know, U.S. soccer. Included in that 3 million are AYSO at like 600,000 and SAY at another 100,000. Does this benefit AYSO and SAY at all? Because they're paying members. They pay their annual dues to be a member of U.S. soccer. This does not benefit them. It does not benefit them.
Yeah. Although I will defend U.S. soccer for a minute here because, you know, when you're in a membership. I know, really. I'm the good cop on this one. Sometimes you have to make tough choices for the betterment of your organization that might not benefit the majority of your members. So, okay, let me play devil's advocate here, even though I don't necessarily agree with this. With these rule changes that came in 2015, my argument as the U.S. soccer defender would be, you know, we're moving away from our own style of thinking about soccer. We're going to do more international thinking. We're going to be more open to international thought about how the game is played. We're going to open our borders and going to be more welcoming to soccer thought. The problem is if we do this over a long period of time, it's going to be haphazardly implemented, and it's almost as bad as not implementing at all. Let's bite the bullet. Let's do it over a 2-year period. We'll offer support. We'll offer we'll offer resources on the website, and let's get this in place so we're all on a level playing field, and then we can take the next steps in developing soccer, in this country. That's the argument I could see is for these kind of rule changes where, you know, the governing body is sitting there saying we've got to look 10, 20 years in the future, and it's going to stink in the first 5 years of any change. You know, there's going to be adjustment. There's going to be players lost. But, you know, the players that come out of it are going to be better representatives for the sport. I mean, these 14-year-olds who drop out of soccer, are they dropping out completely, or are they going to become referees? Are they going to be coaches one day when they have their own kids? Are they going to be, you know, paying customers to the local professional or semi-pro soccer team? Are they really out of the game, or are they just not playing the game themselves in a organized system, but they're still involved, and the knowledge that they've taken is now going to be passed on to their future children or to the clubs they coach or anything else like that? I think that's my counterargument if I'm defending U.S. soccer.
And it's valid. And I do agree with the Band-Aid thing, because that's what we did. Our club, we just went ahead and implemented everything immediately, because it's like, we might as well just get over with. Why delay the inevitable? Let's just do it. And then let's deal with the fallout. And let's just be very honest with our club members and deal with it. I applaud them on that. I really do. If it needed to be done, it needed to be done. The thing that I really wanted to see was the science. And I go back to that. Where's the science in making the field, you know, putting more field players on the field? Where's the science in the age thing? Because Canada studied the age effect, the relative age effect, before they made any changes to hockey, because they were very aware that December births. I mean, you look around, and it's been done in baseball, it's been done in hockey, it's been done in sports, that it's the kids with the December birthdays when it's done by birth year are the ones that seem to float to the top. And it's not because December is the best month to have an athlete. So don't start scheduling your birth based on January. Don't start scheduling your birth based on January. It's not that. It's because they're older. They're bigger, older, and stronger in the beginning. And so they're the ones that don't get overlooked. They're the ones that don't get cut. They're the ones that stay in the system and get cultivated and all that, right? So that's why. There's science there. And that was the pushback, as I always said, is, hey, I'm fine with implementing what you want me to implement. Let me see the science. Show me the data. Show me the research, because I'm a research geek. Every time somebody questions something I say, I pull out the research. You know, and when I get up and talk in front of a room of either whether it's 10 or 10,000 people, I'm always leaning on the research, because we're dealing with human beings. So we're just like lawyers. We're like doctors. We're like nurses. We're like you name it. Okay, and they evolve every year, and they look at the science, and they see if this is still the best way to do things based on what the science tells us. And I think we've had this conversation before too, and that's all I wanted. I just wanted to see the science behind the decision, not because we feel we're behind the world or because Germany does it this way or Italy does it this way or whatever. Just show the science, and then I'm with you, you know?
Mm-hmm. So let's do this. Let's walk back and let's go back in time here for a little bit. And okay, you're at your club in 2014 and you start hearing rumblings about possible rule changes because these things don't come out of the air. Can you kind of walk through how the club handles when they hear the first inkling of, hey, there's going to be some rule changes from U.S. soccer and here's what they could be, to actually having your teams go on the field the first day in 2016, 2017 season with those rule changes implemented? Can you kind of walk through the process of like how you go from hearing that rumor to actually finally implementing what comes out of the process?
Well, that's interesting because I was at two different – I actually transitioned in that time, and so I got to see how it was done two different ways. But great. I'll tell you the way that my last club did it. As soon as there were rumblings, there were meetings, and it was all the stakeholders having the meetings. This is what's coming down the pipeline. Where's our stance as a club, and what's our strategy moving forward? We didn't stick our heads in the sand. We started trying to get out in front of it. So everybody's trying to get out in front of it. And so there's a lot of internal meetings going on between the stakeholders. And if you're smart, it's not just the board member who wants their kid on the A team. It's the people that actually have a say in the matter. So we were at our club. We were sitting down with experts, and we were sitting down with the people who had to deal with like the registration and the people who had to deal with tryouts and the coaches and all that. And we're having these conversations. And then we surveyed the club. Here's what's happening as a club. Okay. This is where we're leaning as the people who pay for their kids to play and whose kids are the center of what we do. Where do you stand on this? I actually asked my club. I told, and then what I did is I wrote a very long, very boring, I'm sure, but I wrote an email about here's where we stand. Here's where I stand as your executive director. And I've already vetted this through our board and through all of our stakeholders. Here's where I stand on this topic. And here's what we are going to do. And of course, interestingly enough, that letter got circulated around a bunch of clubs because, mm-hmm. you know, it was like, oh my gosh, this is great. And then I had several people come to our club because they're like, our club didn't say a word to us until it was too late, until trials were coming up. And it's like, well, get ahead of it. Okay. So everybody's trying to get ahead of it. Everybody's communicating now to their membership. This is what's going to happen. And then you've got to make a decision. Are we going to do it now? Are we going to phase it in? Are we going to wait until the last minute and dump this on people? Like, oops, U.S. Soccer did it to us, because I'm sure that happened too, where people like knew it was coming, but they're like, we're just going to blame U.S. Soccer because it makes us look okay. And I mean, I'm sure that happened because it's like, what do? You stick your head in the sand because this is big. This affected a lot of people, 3 million kids. So we actually decided what we were going to do as a club is we were going to implement the age mandate, and we of course implemented the field sizes and the roster sizes immediately. We held off on the playout rule because we build out rule because we really weren't sure what was going to happen. And here's the problem. It was said the very first time we sat down and had a conversation about this. They'll change their minds. It'll change. It will change. It will not. And it happened. I don't know if you recall, but it got changed mid tryout on me. I was so livid. An email came through mid tryout. We had done everything. We'd selected teams. We had put in, and I get this email about an interpretation of the age mandate rule. And I'm like, are you flipping kidding me? It's the middle of tryouts, and now you're going to. And it's because there was so much pushback that they started altering things to meet the needs of everybody. And I was like, I knew this was going to happen. I knew this was going to happen. Is there were going to be changes, mandates. The mandate was going to be altered right in the middle of trials. But we dealt with it. And here's the other thing in that process. The end of the day, we took full responsibility. At the end of the day, we stood in front of our club members and said, look, these are the mandates. We've made this decision. If you are angry, feel free to vent on me because I'm the one that's carrying it out. And then, of course, I wrote a very nice letter to my friends at U.S. Soccer saying, hey, you know, you made these mandates, and I just wanted you to know I'm the one that took the verbal beating for it. So there's that.
Yeah, I'm sure they read that thoroughly.
Yeah, I was a team player on it. You know, we were team players. We had to. And in my letter, I laid out why I did it for the good of the children. Like, I tried to find the silver. Most clubs try to find the silver lining. Like, this is how it will benefit the children in the long run. Like you did. This is how it will benefit the children in the long run. I mean, that's the thing, is we remained loyal. And I towed the line, and I did what was expected, and I was a team player. Now that I'm not in soccer, I feel like I'm standing on the outside looking in. I feel like I'm going to speak my piece on how things are being done, you know, and of course I'm realizing I'm not alone. So, you know.
Yeah. There's one or two other people who might have issues with how things are done at the national level and how it trickles down to the youth level. I've read one or two things by some people.
One or two things. So this is where I can bring in my second piece. Remember I said the first thing was you can't legislate good coaching, right? The second one is you cannot make decisions for an entire population based on a few people. And we see that politically too, right? We see that in our world in general, right? What's good for me is good for everybody, right? No. We made a decision for 22 men, not 44 men and women, but 22 men. All this was done so the men can win a World Cup. That is what was said. Okay. And it was, you know, it's been obvious. Okay. Right. That is eliminating half your half your population right there. I mean, you're going to completely ignore the women. And how does any of this benefit, you know, like, for instance, there were situations when it came down to, like, the DA and stuff. It's like, how does this benefit the girls? You know, when I was at a club that was switching its training philosophy and everything based on they wanted to get a DA designation, I'm like, that's great. But we have more female players in our club than we do male. So how does that benefit them? You know, that was pre-women's DA. But anyway, we made this decision for a small number of people. Again, I'm a big 99% guy. I said it in my TEDx. I said it every chance I get. Man, we have got to make decisions for the 99%, not the 1%. And we made a decision for the 1%. And I'm telling you this. I can't be the only one that's seen this. If you keep them in the game longer with more opportunity to develop, your talent pool is bigger at the top. So why is it we keep flipping, cutting them all, and eliminating from the process way, way, way down early in the pyramid? And then we get to the top, and everybody keeps going, Leslie Law's like, is this the best we can put on the field? Well, yeah, because we cut the rest of them years ago.
Yeah.
We mandated the heck out of them. I mean, I'm sorry, but when people complain that, you know, is this the best we can put on the field for a game? Yeah, because our pool was really small by the time they got to be that age.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll bring this. Finland came over as ambassadors to U.S. hockey. U.S. hockey went over there to study their model because here you're smaller than most of our states, and yet you're dominating the world in hockey. So what's going on there, right? I mean, come on. Same thing. There's some very small countries dominating the world in soccer. So it can't be numbers. It's got to be something else in the system. It's got to be cultural, right? We went over to study them. They came over and sent over ambassadors over here and studied up. And then we did shared best practices because U.S. hockey said, we're going to stop this attrition rate. We're going to stop this craziness, right? This is years ago. And I applaud U.S. hockey because they're the ones that everybody should be looking at and going, you know what, maybe we should listen to them. Now, at the grassroots level, it's not always being implemented, but they got the right idea at the top, right? This guy's bragging to the Finnish coaches that he just cut 180 kids to keep the top 20 kids in the Northeast. And it's like, this is a regional team. These are the top 20 kids. These are going to be the best. They're going to be fast-tracked to the Olympic team. We're really building talent here. And one of the coaches raised his hand, Finnish coaches, and says, what about the other 180? He goes, who cares about them? I kept the best 20. That's what matters. And he's like, but they're 12. So what about the other 180? The guy's like, it doesn't matter. We got the best 20, and we're going to give them all the resources we can so that they can become their very best. And he's like, but you left 180 bodies on the table who you could have given resources to as well. He's like, you don't understand. That's how we do it. We give them all a chance, and we let it then sort of shake out on its own. You give resources to everybody because you just don't know at 12 years old where your talent's going to come from. Your best player at 12 could not even be on the roster at 18. Mm-hmm. And your worst player at 12 might be your captain. Mm-hmm. And the guy's like, but we kept the top 20. There you go, folks. But we fielded a 22-man World Cup roster, 23-man World Cup roster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you left 3 million bodies on the table, guys.
I guess the ends justify the means in some ways. I can't. You got to stop talking about the women's game because I'm starting to get angry, and that's a topic for another episode. I can't. I got a fundraising email for the U.S. Women's Development Academy, and I had to shut down my browser for a couple hours lest I say something inappropriate that would get me in trouble for going off on U.S. soccer. But
I'll just say this. Go to a conference, go to coaches' clinics, go to any kind of, I mean, go to any soccer-related gathering and see how many of the men are, how many of the coaches and speakers, et cetera, are men and how many are women.
Mm-hmm. And then look at how many of your coaches at the rec level and then the other levels are women. So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let me ask you this question to take it, turn it down a notch.
Is it that bad? Maybe we shouldn't air this.
it's very truthful. I mean, this is the kind of thing that, you know, as parents or, you know, you all who are administrators and coaches get this, like, I mean, this is stuff getting poured on you every day. And it is terrible stuff to go through because, like you said, you're the ones who have to deal with the mandates coming down from on high. And then you also have to deal with the parents and the players who are angry if the mandates from on high are terrible. I mean, you're stuck in the middle of, you know, doing business and having to deal with these things. But let me ask you this question. We'll talk about some of the other things from U.S. soccer. You know, we focused on the big 2015 rule changes, but there are little tweaks here and there throughout. You know, what are those kind of tweaks like? You know, when you hear about those, is it the same way or is it less attention to play to it, or the day-to-day operations of an office, you know, of a club office, like how is U.S. soccer involved in those day-to-day operations?
They stay relatively out of it. I mean, that's one of the other things I applaud them for, is they make a mandate, and then it's like they give us the freedom to sort of – they give us the commander's intent, and then they give us the freedom to carry out the battle as we see fit to reach the commander's intent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always feel – I never always felt – actually, it's the opposite. I never felt micromanaged. I actually felt neglected. You know, I mean, it's you feel neglected because you're like, I'm carrying this out, but I need more from you. And it's because sheer numbers, sheer volume, we're a huge country. We've got a lot of kids. We've got a lot of fragmentation, and that's our fault. And that's where I have to have some forgiveness, some grace or mercy for U.S. soccer is we are so flipping fragmented. Everybody uses the word elite. Everybody uses the word select. Everybody mm-hmm. uses the word premier. And it's like, my kid's seven. He's on the sixth team in a club of, you know, eight teams at this age, and he's on the premier team. I'm like, maybe we're just throwing that word around a little bit too much. And he's only seven, so who gives a darn, right? I mean, mm-hmm. how are you defining premier? He eats his orange slices faster than everybody else? I mean, come on, you're seven, folks. Let's get some perspective. And then everything's fragmented at the pro level. But which one's Division II? Which one's Division III? Is there a Division IIIA? Division 3Z and now PDL. What's it's like? We're just fragmented. And do you go U.S. club, or do you go U.S. soccer? Do you go ECNL? Do you go female women's DA? Do you go high school versus DA? What do you do? I mean, we are all over the board. We do not have a progressive model at all. So what do you expect U.S. soccer to do if we can't even get our act together as a nation when it comes to soccer? And it's economics. We do what we do for economics.
So, all right, ball's in your court. I asked this question for the Concussion Podcast. You're elected president of U.S. Soccer. You've defeated Sunu Gulati on your camp, your platform of, you know, World Cups every 2 years in the U.S. or whatever you want to run on.
Cake what, for everybody. Yeah. Let them eat cake. That's my.
that's a popular one in my household. So what? What are the, what do you do? What are the changes that you make? You know, you're sitting in the office, although I don't know if he even has an office, but let's say you have an office as the elected president of U.S. Soccer. The paperwork comes on your desk. Your executive director walks in and says, what are our priorities for this year? And you say, what? For working with clubs, let me put it this way. For working with clubs.
Flip the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
We're putting all of our best resources, all of our top coaches, and all of our best training with a very high level. And if we really want to be serious about it, we got to start getting into the grassroots, and we got to start giving resources to them. I was just with AYSO. They're screaming for resources. And you have to remember, multiple U.S. national team and World Cup players have come out of AYSO. Mm-hmm. When kids are 3, 4, 5, and 6 years old, that's where they start. If you want them to have a great career track in soccer, you've got to give them a solid foundation from the moment they set foot on the field, and we're not doing it. And these coaches, these poor coaches who raised their hand at the parent meeting and said, I'll coach my kid, are screaming for the resources, and we ignore them, and then we complain about them. Oh my gosh, these rec people, they don't even know what they're doing. They're giving me these players, and they don't have any foundational skills. Have you given them a coaching clinic? Have you given them any resources? Have you even noticed them over there? No. You just, when you inherit their kids, you steal their kids. Sorry, when you go and steal their kids, you get angry that they don't have any skill sets, and it's because it was the poor parent who raised his hand who'd never even seen the game of soccer before. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Flip the pyramid. But you got $100 million in the bank, and what are you talking about? Where are you going to put that money? It should be in coach education, coach training, and resources for the youngest, the least, and the lost. Plain and simple, because half our population is even lost in the picture when it comes to cultivating soccer in the U.S. Secondly, we've got to change the way we train our coaches. We are professionals. We are not weekend warriors doing some stupid hobby. We are professionals, and we need to start acting like it. I am sick. I am sick of people making the excuse that they're volunteer coaches, so we shouldn't make them do that. Yeah? As John O'Sullivan says all the time, yeah, well, you know what? Volunteer firemen and women still have to go through the training too. I don't care if they're volunteer. Give them the resources and make them use those resources, because I'm telling you this now. If you're a volunteer fire person and you opted not to do any training, I don't want you coming to my house when it's on fire. All right? But yet I'll let you coach my kid even though you don't have any training whatsoever. Okay? Mm-hmm. So we've got to start treating it like a profession. And what does that mean? Start going to the data. Why are we still doing it the way we did it 30 years ago? It's not working, okay? And science tells us that, because the world evolves and every other profession on the world evolves, and yet somehow we're still coaching and we're still teaching X's and O's and we're still doing everything else the way we did 30 or 40 years ago. My goodness, If I showed up at my doctor's office and he said, hey, I got this great procedure I learned in 1967. Let's try that now. I'd be like, I'm going to go get a second opinion, my friend, because I'm pretty certain the science has changed and I'm pretty certain there's a better way to do that now. We don't use leeches anymore. I got a blood disorder. I'm going to a phlebotomist. I'm not having leeches stuck on my body. And yet that's how we do it, right?
Phlebotomist, nice pull.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I read sometimes. And then finally, we're going to train them on things. We're going to train them on the software. I am sick of the focus on the hardware. I am just absolutely gutted on the focus of the hardware. How many on-field sessions do we need to do to teach one skill when we – it's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. How many on-field sessions we'll do at a conference or something, and yet there's like three or four people that are there to talk about psychology or long-term athletic development or communication mm-hmm. skills, and then we got, well, they rotate through you every couple – through me every couple of years. My God, when I was a teacher, the first class I took was ethics. We don't even teach that. And the second class I took was communication. You know, it's like they're in child development. Child development had nothing to do with teaching math to five-year-olds, but let me tell you something. Knowing child development, I got really good at teaching math to five-year-olds, so yet we don't do that. And that's the response I get from coaches who are in the know and get it all the time is I wish they'd told me about how to communicate to a five-year-old. I wish they'd explained to me the Piaget's theories or Erickson's theories on development. I wish I'd understood child motivation. I wish I would have understood that saying this will turn the brain off, and saying this will turn the brain on, which will elicit high performance. I wish I'd have known those things, but all I knew how to do was to set them up in a skill or in a drill and drill them to death.
Mm-hmm.
So change the way we train our coaches and require, not make it optional, but I mean hardcore require, like we do doctors, nurses, and even real estate agents and everybody else, require them to have regular CEUs that are put out there by professionals. Because Richard Bailey said it. He surveyed a bunch of coaches who went to a professional licensing course and asked them what they learned. And he said what they came back and said was not only pseudoscience, it was flat out lies. So we've got people training our coaches who do not know what they're talking about. And yet somehow those of us who actually have the science behind us, we're standing out in the weeds trying to yell from the weeds, hey, I can actually show you a way to do this that the science says is a way to do it. But we're on the outside looking in because we speak out against this. So there's my build from the bottom up, give the coaches the resources, focus on the 3 million kids. That's probably the things I do. Oh, last piece. Sorry. Get everybody in line. Get everything in line. We have got to have some kind of progression that parents and kids and coaches and everybody else can look at and point to as dots on the map. Because right now what we got is somebody just did a, you know, ink blot. They did a Rorschach on the map and said, there's our map to get to Shangri-La. And you're like, I don't know how to get to Shangri-La. Man, give them a progression because there's too many leagues. There's too many affiliates. There's too many – just create some kind of progression. So we know if you're here, you can move to this level, and you can move to this level, and you can move to this level, and someday maybe you'll be at this level. Mm-hmm. We don't have that, and that's that whole pro rel argument, right? We don't have it.
You said the word that cannot be spoken. Oh, there goes the podcast that's down in flames. Oh, jeez. Oh, exactly.
I'm not saying pro rel. I'm saying we got to have some kind of progression though, because this is crazy to have everybody put their fingers in the pot, and it's all about it's a money grab. It's a $15.3 billion industry in youth sports, and everybody's just trying to get the piece of the pie. Yeah. Versus, you know, let's create some kind of progression so our athletes have something to work through.
It's an alphabet soup of leagues and options and things like that. And, you know, I live in an area where there are a lot of federal agencies, and I think that the number of acronyms in club soccer, it even befuddles those people. They sit there and go, that's a lot of acronyms. We probably shouldn't use that many. And that's saying something.
I'd love to give the acronyms that we have for soccer to Trump's cabinet and see them, because you know that's all they deal with is acronyms all day long, and they'd probably be baffled.
Yeah, it's you see the parents who work in federal agencies or federal contractors, and they probably shake their heads and go, can't even keep track of all these things. But I mean, you're right. From a most practical perspective, if you have a child that you're like, you know, hey, let's go to a tryout. Are you really sure where that child is in the grand scheme of things? Like, even if you're a smart parent, you're sitting there going, you know, I'd be great if my child got a scholarship. It'd be great if my kid was on a Wheaties box one day. But I just want my kid to be in a good, supportive environment and have fun. Besides your research and what the club tells you, you're never really sure where your child is in this grand scheme of things. You know, you don't know what the progression is in leagues and in things like that. It's just a trust factor, I think, a lot of times at the clubs. It's like, I trust this club to do what's best for my child and pick the league that's best for the child. There is no roadmap, and that's the thing. You can't sit there and say, this club puts these teams in this league and then this league, and they're going to move up, and that makes sense. There's no roadmap. It's very much just out there. And there's a lot of trust that has to be put in clubs, and that puts a lot of pressure on club administrators, again, that you make the right choices, because God forbid you make the wrong choice, you're losing kids that way too.
Totally. And listen, it's the old saying, let's keep honest people honest, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't have any kind of clear vision, there's no vision. There's never been vision. There's never been any kind of, we're not treating it like a business, right? Jim Collins is probably flipping out over the type, there's no good and great happening here. There's no clear vision. Michael Porter's like, what the world's going on with these guys, right? We've never done anything like Texas SWAT or anything. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. There's no vision for us, okay? And what happens is people take advantage of the system. So now we're trusting club administrators and coaches and other people to do what's right for the kids and not to do what builds their resume, boosts their ego, or fattens their bank account, right?
Mm-hmm.
Keep honest people honest. I mean, give them a progression, and then somebody can't tell a lie to, like, well, we play in the Midwest Regional League, and that's far better than the ECNL, so you want to be with our club and not that club. And it's like, did we, or you were just trying to add a tennis team so you could make a little bit more revenue?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We don't know. But if you've got clear vision there, then you know this is the best. This is the best development, and it's not about the league and wins. This is the best development environment, and we're going to put the kids through that progression. And no matter what club you're at, this is the progression that's followed. And then you can pick your clubs and your coaches and all that based on the progression, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how we'll end on this question. So as a parent with a travel player, travel players, what can you do to kind of you're not going to be able to change U.S. soccer. What can you do to kind of make this situation better, make this relationship better between the National Federation, your club, and you and your player? Like, how can you do anything to impact this? Is there any way that you can write letters, whatever?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think they're messages in a bottle. I'm not sure. Here's my advice. I get asked all the time, what advice would you give to, when I do like the webinar I was just on, they ask, it was for baseball, but it's like, what advice would you give to parents and coaches? The only, and I always have a different answer because there's so many things we could do, right? I mean, these are human beings. There's so many different ways we could approach this. Make it love of the game, make it fun, make it this. I think it boils down to one thing, okay? I don't know if you can change the system. I don't know if you want to change the system. I don't know if the system's, I think it could be different. I don't know if it's as bad as I'm making it out to be. I'm just a little livid because it's like, I just feel like we're, doing the same thing again and again and expecting different results here for the last 30 years. But anyway, here is the one piece of advice I can give parents. Look beyond the game. Stop worrying about the mandates. Stop worrying about what league the kid plays in. Stop worrying about what team, badge they're wearing. Stop worrying about World Cups and scholarships and how many goals they scored and how many kids went to college from this club versus how many kids are in the National League from this club versus how many kids are playing in the MLS stop worrying about all that stuff. Look beyond the game. Make the decision for your kid to play based on 30 years from now what this does for him or her. Because if everything you do is based on, listen, the game is going to – my kid may not be on that 23-man or 23-woman roster someday. So my kid is doing this for some other reason. I've got to have a why here. Okay, you can't do life based on a what. You've got to do it on a why. You've got to have this deep-seated reason for the things you do that is meaningful and bigger than yourself. Why is your kid playing sports? And you make all your decisions based on that. If you want your kid to have fun, make a decision. If your goal is that 30 years from now your kid had great mentors who built into him or her, made him an excellent human being with great values and some good life skills to succeed, then pick the club that does that. Pick the team that does that. Pick the league that does that and do that. And if it's not matching up with your why, your vision beyond the game, don't do it. And that's what I had to finally tell parents who were upset with me about the age mandates and stuff. I said, why is your kid playing sports? Because of this. Then do that. And if my club's not the club for you because that's not what you want, do that. Because in the end, 99% of these kids will never, ever put on a national team jersey. So why are we going so crazy and spending so much money and acting so wild when we're missing the point? They're going to go on and do something special in life, and we have the opportunity to shape who they are, what they do, and why they do it with this sports experience. Stop stressing about the gosh darn World Cup and get perspective here. Give your kids a chance to be great human beings beyond the game.
Yeah, love it. Love it. Always comes back to that, and I think that's the best way to do it. All right. Well, I think it's time to settle this U.S. soccer argument, and I'm glad we did a topic that's a little bit bigger than some of the usual stuff that we do, because I think it like I said, it impacts all of us, and it's a good to get this out in the open. So
we have the time when this drops, because I won't be able to leave my house for about 3 months.
Yeah, you have to worry about your reputation. They don't know who I am yet.
Speaking engagements and everything are going to drop. Actually, don't have me come speak at your organization if you disagree with what I say, because, I mean, yeah, whatever.
Well, and that's a statement in of itself, where it's like, you know, and this is true of other – this isn't just a U.S. issue. This is true of other federations as well. You know, the fact that, you know, federations think that they're above reproach, that they know what's best and they don't take criticism well, you know, dude, this is a sport that has been around for 100 – since 1876 or so. It's a international sport. It's played all over the world. It's okay to admit that there are other ideas out there, and that maybe what you think isn't – I mean, this isn't, you know, like life or death. This is sport, and it's okay to admit that there are other ideas out there. And that's one of the things that bothers me, is this idea that, you know, there can be no criticism. I mean, there is one way to do this, and this is the way that we say it. And if you disagree with it, then you should be, you know, ignored or whatever. I mean, like you said, this is a sport, man. I mean, this is what it is at the end of the day. So.
Well, you know, it's funny. My dad used to always say, the moment you think you're the smartest man in the room, Reed, you're going to get your butt handed to you. And that's kind of how I feel at this point. It's like, okay, keep thinking you're smart. You know, and it is fine. I mean, I am sure. I know for pretty certain that there are times where I've been passed over to come speak at conferences and stuff like that because of my views. But that's great.
So people want to hear more about your thoughts and everything. You're on Twitter. You're at @coach_Reed. Where else?
Only if you agree with what I just said.
Well, you don't have a check mark next to your name, so that could be a fake account, right?
Yeah. They won't get. I've tried. I tried to get the check mark. So my wife said the other day, she's like, I said,
there's too much pressure to get the check mark. People actually expect you to say smart things.
Yeah, I know, and I don't want that. No. I just regurgitate stuff that other smart people said.
Bingo. That's what that retweet
was. I stood on
for.
The shoulders of giants. I could see so far because I stood on the shoulders of giants.
That's what the beauty of the retweet button is. Yeah, ditto what that smart person said. So, well, I'm at Robert Hay Jr. Thank you to Soccer Nation for hosting the podcast and all the great work they do. Listen to their podcast. Listen, read their stuff on the website. It's excellent. It's good perspective from all different levels of soccer, from the highest levels to us lowest levels. So with that, Coach Reed, I think you have something you want to end this episode on?
Yeah, shot happens. But you know what? Just keep looking beyond the game and it won't matter.